But just where does Manjushri come from? Where does myth come from? It's easy to understand where Vimalakirti comes from. Vimalakirti has historical existence. His is an historical personality, or at least it's represented as such. So the question of where he comes from just doesn't arise. It's the same with the Shakyamuni, the same with Gautama the Buddha. There's no question of where he comes from. He's just there, so to speak, on the stage of history. But Manjushri, the figure of Manjushri, requires some explanation. He's not found in the Pali scriptures. So where does he come from? How did he get into Buddhism? How did he get into the Mahayana? How did he get into the pages of the Vimalakirti Nirdesha? How did he get into the Buddha's assembly? This is quite a question. But before going into it, I want to stay just a little longer with the actual meeting of Manjushri and Vimalakirti. I've called it a confrontation. But it was more than that, as you'll see for yourself if you just read this particular chapter of the text. It was a vigorous and a rigorous dialectical exchange in which neither spared the other. They really did set to. In a sense, each was out to win. Each was out to defeat the other, but not in an egoistic sort of way. Each was testing the other. Just like you test an earthenware pot to see whether it's cracked or not. Each was experiencing the other in the confrontation, in the rigorous, vigorous dialectical exchange, in the testing. And at the same time, each was experiencing himself in contact with the other. Each was experiencing the truth, the reality of that situation. So the contest between them takes place within a context that is completely positive. I'm reminded of Blake's saying, opposition is true friendship. There's a lot that could be said on this topic, but again, we've no time now. The topic, in fact, deserves a whole lecture to itself. The main point, of course, being that friendship, this very much undervalued word, friendship, especially spiritual friendship, is not something weak, sentimental, indulgent, pusillanimous. It's something vigorous, challenging, demanding, bracing, invigorating, stimulating, inspiring. It's a cold shower rather than a warm bath. In the last talk, we saw Vimalakirti giving proof of this kind of friendship, of this kind of goodwill, in his encounters, that is to say, with the various arhats and bodhisattvas. They, of course, were not quite able to stand up to his rather vigorous friendship. It was rather too much for them. But Manjushri is able to stand it. The two are, in fact, more or less evenly balanced, evenly matched, so they can be friends. I've mentioned Blake's saying, but I'm also reminded of what Nietzsche says in more than one place about one's enemies being really one's friends. One's enemies really being one's friend. The greater the enemy, the better the friend, in fact. And towards the end of chapter 6 of the Vimalakirti Nirdesha, on the inconceivable liberation or emancipation, Bimlakirti himself says, in fact, much the same thing, though he says it in his own way. Mahakashyapa, one of the arahants, has just said, has just exclaimed, in fact, what could the entire host of Maras, that is to say evil ones, ever do to one who is devoted to this inconceivable liberation? But what does Vimalakirti say? He goes even further. So let's see what he does say. He says, Reverend Mahakashyapa, they're very polite to one another in these Buddhist sutras. Reverend Mahakashyapa, the Maras who play the devil in the innumerable universes of the ten directions are all bodhisattvas dwelling in the inconceivable liberation, who are playing the devil in order to develop living beings through their skill in liberative technique. Reverend Mahakashyapa, all the miserable beggars who come to the bodhisattvas of the innumerable universes of the ten directions to ask for a hand, a foot, an ear, a nose, some blood. They do all these things in the Jataka stories, you may remember. Blood, muscles, bones, marrow, an eye, a torso, a head, a limb, a member, a throne, a kingdom, a country, a wife, a son, a daughter, a slave girl, a horse, an elephant, a chariot, a cart, gold, silver, jewels, pearls, conches, crystal, coral, bearer, treasures, food, drink, elixirs, and clothes. These demanding beggars are usually bodhisattvas living in the inconceivable liberation who, through their skill in liberative technique, wish to test and thus demonstrate the firmness of the high resolve of the bodhisattvas. Why? Reverend Mahakashyapa, the bodhisattvas demonstrate that firmness by means of terrible austerities. Ordinary persons have no power to be thus demanding of bodhisattvas unless they are granted the opportunity. They are not capable of killing and depriving in that manner without being freely given the chance. Reverend Mahakashyapa, just as a glowworm cannot eclipse the light of the sun, so, Reverend Mahakashyapa, it is not possible without special allowance that an ordinary person can thus attack and deprive a bodhisattva. Reverend Mahakashyapa, just as a donkey could not muster an attack on a wild elephant, even so, Reverend Mahakashyapa, one who is not himself a bodhisattva cannot harass a bodhisattva. Only one who is himself a bodhisattva can harass another bodhisattva, and only a bodhisattva can tolerate the harassment of another bodhisattva. Reverend Mahakashyapa, such is the introduction to the power of the knowledge of liberative technique of the bodhisattvas who live in the inconceivable liberation. Well, you may remember that in the course of the last talk, we saw that Indra, the king of the gods, approached the bodhisattva Jagatindra. And what did he do? Do you remember? He offered him 12,000 heavenly maidens. And Jagatindra refused the maidens. Then Vimalakirti came along. And he said that it was not Indra. He said that it was Mara, the evil one. But in the light of the passage just quoted, we can go even further than that. Indra was Mara, yes. But who was Mara? I leave you to work it out for yourselves.